Thank you. Okay, I'd like to begin by thanking the organizers for letting me give this talk. So indeed, I'm going to talk about topological pumping, but I'm going to talk about topological pumping in systems which are very far from being in equilibrium, and I'll explain what I mean by that exactly. So kind of generally, you know, I've been thinking in the last few years, I've been thinking about topological phenomena that are induced externally by a drive, by a, say, time-periodic drive, specifically. You know, this goes back to the Middle Ages, where the alchemist tried to convert lead into gold by shining moon rays. You know, we consider this sort of modern alchemy, where we're now shining maybe some laser light on our system. So, if you want to discuss topology in time-periodic systems, we want to start, or in time-dependent systems in general, we want to see how could we kind of approach this problem. So in the most general case, where there's some arbitrary time dependence, this is a very hard problem because there's no eigenstates that we could use. However, if the system is time-periodic, then we could use Floquet's theorem, which is basically, you know, Locke's theorem is in fact Floquet's theorem. So this is a Locke's theorem in time, if you want. And one way to formulate it is that the unitary time evolution operator could be factorized into a periodic piece, this W. So this is W. This W is a unitary matrix which is time periodic, times an exponential of a fixed matrix, which is time independent. We call the eigenvalues of this matrix HF, we call them quasi-energies. One thing to note is these quasi-energies, we usually take them in the interval between 0 and omega, because we can always absorb an omega t into the periodic piece. So the eigenvalues of this matrix are really only defined mod omega. Okay? So now, one way to kind of discuss any topological classification would be just to ask, okay, let's look at this operator, HF, you know, into which type of topological class does it fall into? We could try to use the topological classes we know from time-independent Hamiltonians. What I'll argue is that this is actually not a full classification of time-periodic systems. And there are systems which I cannot obtain their topological classification but just by thinking about this operator. I actually have to know the full time dependence of the system. Okay, so just a very quick overview. So if we now have also a lattice system or a system with translation with a discrete translation invariance, we now basically have Floquet Bloch bands, which are characterized by the quasi-momenta and their quasi-energies. So this is kind of a cartoon spectrum. And indeed, if you just look at this spectrum, this is the spectrum of this HF that I've just discussed, you might think that all you need to do is just see which topological class under the table of equilibrium systems that fall into. Okay, there have been several proposals to basically turn systems which are not topological or almost topological, like Ruffin, into a topological one by subjecting them to, say, a weak external drive. For example, if you subject graphene to a weak external circularly polarized electric field, you'll end up with kind of a Haldane. The HF, the effective Hamiltonian, you'll end up with is that of in the Haldane model, basically. Another thing you could do is actually induce topological states by inducing, basically driving the system with a resonant frequency. Resonant, I mean, a frequency which creates a resonance between the valence and conduction band. So I'm going to talk about systems which are slightly different. So these systems here, they actually, to classify them, you can actually use the existing topological classification of time-independent systems. Okay, and several different realizations. This is a realization in the solid-state system by the group of Nugedic. This is a realization in a cold atom system. And this is a realization in an own optical system. Question? Okay, so now let's think what happened if we have a closed interacting system which is also kind of externally driven. So what would you expect from such a system? So what you expect that the system, if it's closed and it has interacting particles and it's external gradient, you expect the system to go to basically infinite temperatures at infinite temperature at long time. And the reason is, one way to understand this is to consider some initial state and remember that the quasi-energy basically is only conserved mode omega. So you can make transitions which are not possible in equilibrium systems. For example, the transitions here in green. And basically, these type of transitions, if you think about this kind of particle picture, basically would drive the system to have entropy, a local entropy, which is maximum. Okay, so the system, of course, remains in a pure state if it starts in a pure state. However, if you look at the entropy of a finite segment, you'll see that it approaches maximal entropy. So this seems to be the fate of interacting driven systems. And the question is, okay, this seems like not a very good situation to observe topological phenomena. This is a very hot and uninteresting state. Can we end up with something more interesting in driven systems? So,
am I supposed to imagine that this transition is driven by interaction?
Yeah, so you can consider a scattering event, which is instead of conserving energy, usually that's what you used to, here it conserves quasi-energy but mod omega. So in total it does absorb an omega. Okay. So what we want to ask is, so what type of topological phenomena can we actually stabilize in a driven system? Are we always going to end up with a very hot state, or can we end up with something that actually exhibits topological behavior? So I'm going to discuss two approaches. One approach is to use disorder, and specifically I'm going to discuss a very interesting state, what we call the anomalous Floch-Anderson insulator. And this state is an example of a state that actually cannot be understood as a part of the classification of equilibrium systems. And I'll explain exactly why. And another approach I'll discuss is to look at quasi-steady states, so states that form at intermediate times and are very long-lived. And I'll show that, for example, we can construct a state that carries a chiral current that basically exhibits the topological nature of the Floquet block bands in a one-dimensional system. But this idea can be generalized to any other dimension or systems with other symmetries. Okay, so the first part of the talk discusses this anomalous Floch-Anderson insulator, and this is work together with Mark, Gil, Erez, and the student from Caltech that now moved to Maryland, Paraj Ditu, which did most of the heavy lifting. And indeed, in this part of the work, we want to rely on the fact that in periodically driven systems, there are new topological configurations which are not possible in time-independent systems because the quasi-energy is also a periodic. Okay. So one way to begin is to think about just why can't we have a pure chiral mode in a one-dimensional system? This is purely unphysical. Just because of the chiral anomaly, if we do a gate transformation, we end up with number of particles not being conserved. However, we know that if you really look at the edge of the quantum Hall effect, we do see a chiral dispersion, but that's okay because the bulk bands actually compensate, and they actually the charge appearing on one edge of the system is actually depleted from the other edge and goes through the bulk. But in a Floquet system, we can resolve. Okay, so one more thing, and we also know that the fact that we have edge state, therefore, because of this anomaly, is that the fact that we have edge state also necessitates the fact that we have bands with Chern numbers. So having a chiral edge state will necessitate having non-zero Chern numbers in the bulk. Now, in a Floquet system, the situation is different because now we basically can have a spectrum in which an edge state a one-dimensional mode can basically wrap around the Bloch Floquet zone. So it could start, say, minus pi, and end up at pi pi, and therefore it completely avoids this anomaly because number of particles will just be conserved if I do a gate transformation. Okay, so the question is, how can we arrive at this situation where we basically have a system which only contains these two chiral modes. So this system is indeed this anomalous Rocke-Anderson insulator. So this is a disordered system, which I'll show has a fully localized bulk, but has topologically protected edge modes. Okay, this, and I want to again stress the difference between this and a quantum Hall system. In a quantum Hall system, you always have at least one state that's delocalized. And in this system, there are actually absolutely no bulk states which are delocalized. All the bulk states have a finite localization length. Okay, so let's see how this can arise. So the first thing you want to think about maybe is a translation invariant system, and you want to consider a spectrum of a translation invariant system, and we want to ask, okay, what could be the possible edge bulk dualities? So what could be the Chern numbers and the edge state spectrum of this type of system? And one thing you realize immediately is that you can have zero Chern numbers for the bulk bands, but have non-zero chiral modes in the gaps. And the reason is basically because the Chern number counts the number of states above your band minus the number of states, chiral states below your band. But anyway, in a Floquet system, you can ask which state is above and which state is below. So here, in this cartoon, this band has Chern number zero. It has one state above and one state below. Both of them are on the same side of the system. And also this state has Chern number zero and has one state below and one state above. Okay, and that's the whole spectrum. Okay, there's no other bands involved in the spectrum of this system. Okay, and so you can ask now, okay, but is there another topological invariant that characterizes this system, which is not a Chern number? And indeed there is. I'm going to come back to it, but you see that this topological invariant does involve the full time-dependent unitary evolution matrix of the system. So you have to know not only these effective Floquet-Hamiltonian, this kind of fixed matrix that I showed you, you all really have to know the full time evolution of the system. Okay, so how can we actually get a spectrum like this? So there's two kinds of types of models that you can consider. One of them is a model which is strongly time modulated. So really, the Hamiltonian is all the same hopping matrix elements in the model are very strongly time modulated. I'm going to discuss this model at length. But you could also arrive at the system just by weakly and homogeneously driving a system, and indeed get a similar spectrum whose Chern numbers are all zero and has chiral edge states in both gaps. Okay, so now let me discuss this modulated hopping model. So this is a very simple model. So what I do in this model, I take my time, my period, and I divide it into four steps. Okay, and in the first step, I turn on these red links over here. So you see that they connect this black sides to the white sides here, and likewise over here. And in step number two, I turn on these vertical links, etc. So I have four steps in total. And now if you follow what a particle does, say if you started at, say, one of these black sites, I should also say I also tune, let's fine-tune first for the moment the hopping matrix elements such that in one of these, one-fourth of a cycle, a particle would move with amplitude 1 from one site to the next. Okay, so let's start a particle on this black side over here. It goes, it moves to the white side here, goes to the black side over here, here, goes here, and then goes back to its initial position over here. Okay, and therefore, if we just look at the bulk states of this model, they're all just completely, basically the evolution operator would just be the identity. Okay, because all particles return to their initial positions. Okay, so this is the spectrum of the system if it would be on a torus, only this kind of black flat, blue flat line. However, now we could consider what would be the situation if we put the system on a cylinder or a system with an edge. And now if you do the same type of following of the particles as we did before, you see that the particle on the edge, if you started on the white side, would move two steps to the left. If you started on the black side, it would actually come back to its original position, and vice versa on the other edge. Okay? So we really manifestly see here these two edge modes. One of them propagates to the left, and one of them propagates to the right on both edges of the system. And again, if I just look at the spectrum of this operator, of the evolution operator for a full period on the torus, I would just see the identity operator. Okay? This tells you that I could not know about the existence of these edge states if I just consider HF, the effective Hamiltonian, on a torus. Okay? Because basically the effective Hamiltonian is the log of this operator. I could also, just for convenience, add the sublattice potential at the end of the fourth step, just to kind of split these two bands. This just makes this thing a little bit more familiar, and I end up with a spectrum like this. And this type of model actually has been realized in very recently in just an all-optical system, where they just kind of move the position of waveguides just according to what I showed you here. So in this type of system, this direction is basically the time direction. They basically employ the Parexel approximation to turn the Maxwell equation, or the Helmholtz equation, into a Schrödinger equation to a good approximation. And this mimics the time evolution of the single particle Hamiltonian that I just showed. Okay, so now what happens if I add this order? So let's do let's start with a very simple thing. I'm staying within this fine-tuned model, and let me do an even more fine-tuned thing. So after this fourth step, I'm going to add a disorder potential, which is only on when all other hopping matrix elements are off. Okay, so I add this at the end of these four cycles. I add another fifth part of the period. I turn on this disorder potential. This clearly leads to the spectrum to be completely localized on the torus. All basically eigenstates are single sites. It would also retain the topological character, okay? Because, for example, I can turn on this disorder potential to be weak enough so these two bands that I showed you before don't touch each other, okay? So clearly, this type of disorder potential leads to a localized state that also has chiral edge modes. The question is, can I add a generic type of disorder potential? And indeed I can. So here we added a generic disorder potential. So here we just turn the disorder potential, on-site disorder potential, which is on for the full period. So it's on meanwhile the hopping matrix elements are being modulated. And what we looked at here is the level spacing ratio. And you can indeed see that as you increase this order strength, you go from a level spacing ratio, which corresponds to delocalized states, to localized states. Now, I should say, the fact that you see here level spacing ratio, which corresponds to delocalized states, only comes from finite size effects. Okay, so here, the localization length is just too large. It's much larger than the size of the system. But in fact, we expect this system to be localized for any arbitrary small amount of disorder. So now let's go back to this bulk.
Yeah. It seems like at this stage the statistics of a particle doesn't even matter. I mean, you could have hardcore bosons.
Yeah. So far I'm only talking about single particle. So the fermionic nature will be important in a second. Yeah. Correct. This is only about single particle physics so far. Right. In this localized state, you can ask, okay, what's the topological invariant that characterizes the state? So what we proposed is to look at this topological invariant, which is again basically counting how many. Basically, it looks at this map from SUN to from the three torus to SUN. But one thing you have to be careful about is that in order to use this topological invariant, you actually have to use a unitary evolution operator that's time periodic, okay? Because this topological environment is only good for basically for maps which are continuous from the three torus to SUN. So what we do, what we propose is to actually take my unitary evolution operator and deform it, multiply it by this exponent, which makes this new operator time periodic. Okay, so if you look at the time evolution of the full time evolution of this operator, you see that it's at t equals zero, it's identity, but also at t equals capital T, it's identity. Okay. Now you see that there is a subtlety. To define this exponent here, so this is exponent of some h effective. What is this h effective? This h effective is the log of u of capital T. So to define this log, I have to choose an energy for which, you know, where I have to choose my zone for quasi energy. So my zone for say zero to omega, or stated otherwise, I have to choose the location of the branch cut of the log. Okay, so this gives us basically this extra index epsilon to this operator u, because this it indicates where is the branch cut for the log when I define this h effective. Okay.
What was u again?
So u, this u is just the time evolution operator.
Okay.
And I consider the system on a torus, and I insert fluxes in the two holes of the torus. Okay. So it's very similar to the setting where in which I would compute, you know, the Chern number for a two-dimensional system, this order system. I have a torus, and I insert an Aronov bound flux in one hole of the torus, another Aronov bound flux in the second hole of the torus. Okay, and now I have a Hamiltonian that depends on both of these fluxes, and it also depends on time in a periodic way.
Okay?
And
nu
is just
evolution.
Yes. So nu is just the path ordered integral of you know zero to this is u of little t. So it's path ordered integral e to the I integral from zero to t dt prime h of theta x theta y t prime. Okay. So it's just the unitary evolution operator corresponding to this Hamiltonian.
Your h was not time periodic.
My h is time periodic, but if h is time periodic, the evolution operator is not time periodic. Okay, that's a confusing thing. Okay, so for any generic Hamiltonian, so the toy model that I showed you before, the fine-tuned model is a case where the unitary operator is also periodic. But more generally, there is no and reason for the unitary operator to also be time periodic if the Hamiltonian is periodic. So we have to deform this operator u in order to make it the time periodic one. And what we do is we multiply by this unitary operator, which exactly cancels. So if you substitute for little t, capital T for little t, you see that this is exactly identity. And u of zero is identity, and this operator, capital T, is also an identity, so it's a periodic value. It's an operator which is periodic in time. Okay, so now that I have an operator which is periodic in time, I can basically use this topological invariant to kind of basically count how many times, or count, it's the topological invariant that looks at the map from the three torus, okay, because now we have a periodic direction for time, for theta x and theta y. Okay, and I'm mapping it into SUN. Okay? So again, so theta is this twisted periodic boundary conditions, and epsilon is the branch cut of this log. But now the price I have to pay is that this evolution operator, this deformed evolution operator, has this index epsilon, because it depends explicitly on this branch cut, because this operator here depends on the way I choose the branch cut for the log.
So does this W of epsilon boil down to Chern number or something if your H was time independent?
If my H was time independent, yeah. So if my H was time independent, so I'll answer in a second, okay? Yeah, it's a good question, I'll answer it. So what you could show is basically that if you look at this W, if you could relate this W to Chern numbers, exactly what you asked, and the relation is the following. So if you ask what's the Chern number of states between energy epsilon and epsilon prime, it would be just the difference between this W of epsilon and W of epsilon prime. So for example, if you have a static system, you could use it to compute this epsilon, but in order to compute the Chern number, you have to compare two W's, one at epsilon above the band and one at epsilon below the band, and subtract them, and then you will obtain the Chern number. So kind of a... So that will be the relation between Chern numbers and these W's. In our system, all states are localized, therefore the Chern numbers are zero. That tells you that basically the W is in fact time independent, epsilon independent, because this side is zero. Therefore, W is of epsilon is, w is equal to W of x epsilon prime for any epsilon prime. Okay? So if in a system where in which all states are localized, you necessarily have that W of epsilon is equal to W epsilon prime. Okay? Now, in a static system, that would also mean that W of epsilon is zero. Okay? If all states are localized in a static system, that would also mean that W of epsilon is zero. Okay? Because all the Chern numbers are zero. But in our case, we can have a situation where both of these, for example, are 1, and the Chern numbers are still 0. Okay? So the take-home message is that if all states are localized in a Floquet system, you could still have a situation where all Chern numbers are 0, but this W is not 0, and in fact, it's epsilon independent. For any epsilon, it's the same. Therefore, I could actually omit this index epsilon completely. Okay? So I have one topological invariant that basically tells me that corresponds to this state. Is that clear?
If W is epsilon dependent, does it still have a meaning?
Yeah, it's a good question. So,
yes,
it has a very clear meaning. So W counts the number of edge states at energy epsilon, the number of chiral edge states at energy epsilon. So you could see this from the Chern number. For example, let's do an example, okay? If you have a system, say, with two bands, and suppose it has Chern numbers minus 1 and 1, okay, and there's on one side of the system there's one edge state, right? So what you'll get that W here is equal to 1, W below this energy would be equal to 0, okay, and W here would be again 0, okay? So that exactly would give you the Chern numbers of each one of these bands.
That's because epsilon not only is a branch cut, but it's also the energy.
Yeah, it corresponds to it corresponds to an energy or a quasi-energy in which I choose the branch cut of my log. So it has a physical meaning. Okay, what happens in this system that I'll now show is that basically, since W is basically one for any epsilon, it means that there is an edge state at all energies. Okay, so indeed, if we look at this system now with edge modes. If consider what happens now. I have a system with Chern number 0. Okay, both Chern numbers are 0. Now I add this order. Now before I added this order, I could use translation invariance and look at the block Floquet states, and I'd see that I have an edge mode here and an edge mode here and an edge mode in this gap as well. Okay, so both of these gaps have an edge mode. Now I add this order. I could ask, okay, what happens to the edge spectrum now? So clearly, if this order is weak enough. These edge states here have to remain stable. The question, what happens here inside this bulk band? So what I want to claim now is indeed what I showed you before, is that now, in this situation, I'll now have an edge state at any energy. And the reason is simple. Consider now inserting, this is a spectrum for a system, say, on a cylinder. Consider inserting a flux. Once you insert a flux, you know that for edge state, you start having basically spectral flow of the edge states. Okay, so each edge state would flow to the edge state for the next lattice momentum. Okay, and now you can ask yourself, okay, what happens when I go along the flow and I reach the bulk band? Now this bulk band is localized. Now this flow can't terminate, right? Because it would make this thing non-unitary. So the edge state that joins the bulk basically has to continue flowing into the bulk. That means that there needs to be an edge state inside overlapping with the bulk bands, which would take care of this flow. Okay? So the picture has to be like this. There has to be an edge state forming inside the bulk bands, which will now make a continuous spectral flow all along the block Floquet zone. Okay? And this is indeed what we see numerically. So for example, what we looked at the Green's function, position-dependent Green's function. So we start a particle at site, this site here, and we look at its propagation at different quasi-energies. And what you could see is, you could see that there is basically an edge state at any of these quasi-energies we tried. We tried also other ones, but this is one I showed. Some of these edge state, some of these energies actually overlap with the original bulk bands. So this is exactly the point, that there is an edge state overlapping with what used to be the bulk bands. On the other hand, if I start a particle on the interior of the system, it does not propagate, so it remains localized. Okay, so now, one more thing. I want to stress the fact that we really have a different phase from a trivial Anderson insulator. Okay, so you can consider what happens if I increase now the disorder strength, keep on increasing the disorder strength. At some point, if the disorder strength is too large, you would expect just to have a trivial Anderson insulator. It's just very, very strong disorder on each side. You don't expect the modulation of the hopping matrix elements to do anything. And this is indeed what we see. We see that actually at very large disorder strength, there is a transition. Okay? Both of these, on both sides of the transition, we have a localized system. So the devastating ratio goes to its localized value. But on this side of the transition is a trivial Anderson insulator, while on this side of the transition, we see that there are edge states, and we also see a very interesting current pumping phenomenon, which I'll now discuss. Okay, so kind of this is the topological side of the transition. This is the trivial side. These are actually two independent phases of this system. Okay, so now let me discuss this pumping current. So I want.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Does the transition involve a gap closure?
No. So at this point, good question. So if you look at this, this is the density of states at the transition or close to the transition. So you see that the density of states is homogeneous. So you need to ask me how does this transition happens, right? That's what you're okay. So really, if you look at the numerics is a little bit misleading because of finite size effect. If you look at it, this is the situation at something that we estimate to be the critical disorder strength. And you see that there is kind of a flat density of states, and the level spacing ratio looks to be as if it attains the value for delocalized states. So it looks like all edge states are delocalized. Okay? But this is probably the result of. So it looks like there's some critical disorder strength at which all states just become delocalized. But what we think is that this is just this numerics is misleading because of the finite size effect. What really should happen if you had if you go for a very large system, what you'd see is when you approach this disorder strength, you first nucleate two states with a Chern number, so say +1 and -1. Okay. And now these two states, they have to wrap around the quasi-energy spectrum and meet on the other side. So you really this is not a single transition. There is actually it's not a direct transition from this side to this side. We think that if you had enough numerical power, you'd see that actually there's an intermediate phase from which there are Chern numbers. But we're not able to resolve it in our numerics. So now let me come to this pumping phenomena. So now the fact that there is this edge state, and this edge state actually wraps around the block Floquet zone, also kind of alludes to the fact that we should see some type of quantized current in the system. Okay, so for example, if we were able to fill all of these edge states, okay, kind of very hand-wavingly thinking, if you have a dispersion for which the EDK, the integral of the EDK is basically say 2 pi, if you fill up all of this band, this type of band, you'd have a current which is basically quantized in the units of the period. Okay. Now, this is not a, this is a system without translation invariance. Nevertheless, we do have this edge state that appears at any point at any quasi-energy in the quasi-energy spectrum. And now we propose the following kind of Gedanken experiment. And I'll propose an actual experiment later, but this is a Gedanken experiment. We take the cylinder and we fill it up only up to some distance from the edge. Okay, so on this side of the system there are filled states, so now it's important that I fill it with fermions. So I take fermions and I completely fill up the system on one side of the system here. It is where this kind of shady region is. It's not important exactly what the trajectory of this boundary region is. What's important is that I fill it up completely all the way to the end and over I kind of overlap with this edge state. And now, what I want to do, and I want to have this as the initial state, and now start my pump, start my driving, and I want to measure the current through a cut. Okay, through, say, a cut in this direction here. What we show is that basically, due to the fact that you have an edge state here, you have a quantized current. So the current would be basically this W, this bulk invariant that I showed you before, divided by the period T. Okay? So this is the quantization of the current. Now, you have to be a little bit more careful. In order to see this quantization, so remember I started with a state in which I arbitrarily filled up this side of the system here. It's not a steady state of the system. So I first prepare the state and I start kind of my driving protocol. What you see is that initially you have a transient, and what we're plotting here the long time average. So we're averaging the current or the charge going through the cut for n periods. Okay, and only if you average it over long times you see this quantization. So in initial dynamics you do see a transient. And it's basically the fact that this boundary region can kind of sway a little bit. Okay, it's not in a steady state, in the beginning at least, so it kind of oscillates a little bit, which tells you that the current in this direction does not need to be absolutely conserved. Okay, therefore you do get this transient, and you could estimate this transient has to be a parallel transient, it has to go faster than 1 over t, which indeed it does.
So how do you feel just the gray area? Is this position?
I take car point and I
color. dropper fermions.
Yeah. So right. So you need to somehow fill up only a specific area, and maybe save this question for later. But I'll try to describe an experiment which is maybe more kind of realizable. Yeah. But this Gedanken experiment assumes that I have an initial state in which one side of the cylinder is filled. The other one is not, and it's not important exactly how
the boundary
region. The transport, that's a very good question, which I'll now answer. The transport, so what I showed you is the current going through a cut of the cylinder here, right? So
top to bottom?
You just take a cut and you ask how much current is. Uh-huh. So there's a net current going through in this direction. Mm-hmm. Okay? Now you should ask me, okay, where is it flowing? Is it flowing on the boundary? That's what you might guess, because on the boundary you have the edge state.
Well, you colored it green.
I colored it green? No, that's where you see the edge state. So the edge state, there is a propagating state that is close to the edge. So what you initially would think, that's what we initially imagined, is that the current is carried by the edge state, so it flows around the edge. But when you think about it a little bit more, you see that this is not possible, because if this region is completely filled, then there could be no currents running here. So the necessarily, the currents are actually running on the boundary of this filled region. Okay? And you can actually see this if you look at this, again, at this toy model. You could actually kind of track exactly where you if you follow these particles, it's very easy to follow particles in this model, and you see that all currents are actually canceled. The currents that are carried by this are actually canceled by the current, by the evolution of particles coming from here. So it's not the edge that actually carries the current, it's actually the current actually carried by on the boundary between the filled and the empty region. That's where you have a current. Okay?
So having the space separation is important.
Yeah, it's very important to have, yeah, because, you know, if you have a completely filled system, it could do nothing.
Yeah, but you don't want them.
You don't want them in patches. Yeah, so now let me think about the situation of a patch. Right, so here, just to reiterate this point, so this is the evolution of a particle on the edge, and this is an evolution of a particle which is not part of the edge state. And you see that the currents here cancel, where this current is actually not canceled. Sorry, So, so now this is the situation of the patch. Okay, so now you could need to ask yourself, okay, so what happens if I have this very large homogeneous system, very large system which is in this AFAI phase, but now I, for some reason, I choose to fill up fermions only in a certain region. Okay, and I think that this region, this yellow region, is filled, is completely filled. I fill up all the sites, and the blue region is completely empty. Okay, now, what would happen if this is my initial state? I now start the driving process. Right? So, if you believe what I just told you, you now remember that there is a current flowing around the boundary of this region. Okay. So, there's a current flowing on the boundary between the filled and the empty region. So now what I want to do, and I want to use Pair's law, okay, to define something I call, we call a magnetization current. Okay, so, think about Pair's law, it tells you that the curl of the magnetization is equal to the current, to the current density. Now, if indeed there is a quantized current flowing here, if you integrate out the current, or integrate out this equation, you see that there is a quantized magnetization in the bulk of this system here. So very deep inside the bulk here, the magnetization is necessarily quantized. Okay, this just comes from integrating Ampere's law. Now there is a subtlety here, which I'll avoid for now at least, is that Ampere's law is really valid only for, we're used to using it, but it really only applies to a system which is stationary. Okay, and this system is actually, it's not completely stationary. So there's a subtlety in when is this magnetization actually well defined? Because if the system is not, if you can't use Ampere's law, then it's not clear how to define even magnetization. Okay, so if you're interested, I could answer this maybe at the end.
So I'm very excited that we're not parking so many of them, but I'm kind of curious what you're dealing with, or how you're dealing with heating.
Right. So far I haven't discussed interactions at all. I just avoided it completely. Now, one might hope that this system would be many-body localized, although I cannot say anything that supports this or doesn't support it. Okay. So
I'm perfectly happy if the answer is well. It seemed like I drew it in PowerPoint. I mean, you know, we assume no interactions.
No, so that's right. Those, right. We assume no interactions.
That's fine.
Right? Now, you might imagine, I think there is an inter, let me say it this way, there's an interesting question. If the system is also many-body localized, then this would survive under interactions, but dealing with many-body localization in two dimensions is hard, so we don't have any concrete thing to say at this point. Okay.
Do you have a sense that there might be even, like, stable to weak interactions?
So it seems that if there is many body localization in two dimensions, and I think the jury is still out, right? If static systems are stable in two dimensions, then I think it's possible that this system is also stable. The only difference between this and so here all the bulk states are localized. The only difference would be that there's some propagating states at the boundary. But, for example, if you think about this scenario, you don't see this propagating state. So,
you
this leads you to think that, you know, many, if there is many body localization in 2D, it should happen also here, but I can't say any more than that. Okay, so now, okay, so I claim that if you use Ampere's law and you remember that there's some subtleties which I haven't discussed yet, at least, you get basically quantized magnetization in the bulk of this system, and the question is how to probe it. So here is a suggestion, which also kind of suggests some interesting analogy between static and Floquet systems. So another way to get a magnetization, to write a magnetization in an equilibrium system would be to write it as a derivative of the energy, or the free energy, or the energy with respect to a magnetic field. So you might want to do the same here. You say, okay, I take the total quasi-energy, okay, and I take its derivative with respect to the magnetic field, and I'll define it, this as the magnetization in this case. Okay. Now it turns out that this is a good definition up to the subtleties that are involved. This the fact, the question whether the system is stationary or not. So you could really define this the total magnetization of the system as the derivative of the quasi, total quasi energy to the magnetic field. So this would give you the same as just counting the magnetization current of each one of the particles. Okay? And if you use this equation, at least for a weak magnetic field, you'd see that this gives you an energy difference between, if I now apply a weak magnetic field, I would get an energy shift that is basically this quantized invariant, this W over T, times the total flux I subject the system to. Okay, so this would be the energy shift once you apply total magnetic flux of delta phi. So what this tells you is that you can basically try to see this in an interferometric way. So for example, you could consider a system, or cold atom system maybe, with spin up and spin down particles, where I'm going to actually apply a very weak magnetic field only for the spin-up particles and not for the spin-down particles. Okay, so I just want to say again, this magnetic field is an extra ingredient beyond this driving that I mentioned. It's a static, if you want, artificial magnetic field applied to the system. It has nothing to do with this driving. It's an additional ingredient. And I apply it only to the spin-up particles. So now, if you read this equation, then the spin-up particles basically acquire a phase shift. So if I start all the particles in the x direction, position of up plus down, I'm going to have a phase shift for the spin-up particles with respect to the spin-down particles, which basically will tell me that the average Bloch vector is now moving in the xy plane. I started on the x direction, and now it's somehow somewhere between the x and the y direction. Okay. And what you could show if you actually kind of follow from this equation, is that this phase is directly related to this invariant and to this magnetization. And in fact, the average y component, we show that the average y component of the spin is just the total magnetization of the system over this the area of the field state times the flux that you apply, times basically the number of periods which you evolve. So as you evolve, this kind of average spin is rotating around the z direction because you're acquiring more and more phase shift. Okay, so you're acquiring a phase shift that is linear in time. It also has a correction. This is a numerical result. By the way, all the numerics and all the heavy lifting actually in this work was done by a student, Frederick Nathan, from the Bohr Institute. So now if you plot this averaged y component of the spin and you divide it, you just normalize it by the total flux and the time, you see that it goes to a quantized value. You also see here that you have this transient. This transient also comes from the fact that the system initially at least is not completely stationary. And also, you notice that in this equation, there is a bit of a question, what is this area of the field region? How do I actually define it? Since, you know, very quickly, the area of the field region becomes a little bit fuzzy. Okay, so in general, this blob that I initialized retains its shape, but that, there is some fuzziness on the boundary. So the fact that the area of the field region is not completely well-defined leads to also a power law correction, which goes to zero when you increase the size of the system. So the take-home message is just by doing this interferometry and looking at the Y component of the spin here, you could actually measure the magnetization, the average magnetization of the system. Okay, so how much time do I not have? Do I have nothing? Okay, so I don't know if you can see the board or not, but I think there's an interesting, I don't know if it's an analogy or an anecdote, but it seems like at least there's two examples that I showed you. If you think about these Floquet systems and static systems, so in a Floquet system, I showed you that the current, there is a quantized current. When in a static system, it's really the derivative of the current with respect to the, say, bias that you apply on the system, that's quantized. So here is the current, here is the derivative of the current, that's quantized. And if you remember, some of you might know, basically, there's this Streda formula that tells you that the Hall conductivity is related to the derivative of the magnetization with respect to the chemical potential. So in a static system, the Streda formula will tell you that the derivative of the magnetization with respect to the chemical potential is quantized, while here it's the magnetization that's quantized. So I'm presuming there are other analogies that you could find that relates observables in Floquet systems to basically to response functions in these static systems. Okay. So with this interlude, and with the remaining few minutes, I just want to quickly mention this work, which maybe addresses the question that was asked about interactions. So now we're not completely, but to a big part, switching gears and thinking about a one-dimensional system. And I want to look at a one-dimensional system that's periodically driven and also interacting. And what I want to claim is that in a certain regime, you could actually obtain a quasi-steady state behavior in the system, which actually is universal. So you obtain a universal state. In this case, it would be chiral, and would basically exhibit the Chern numbers correspond the Chern number of the basically the time-dependent Hamiltonian. Okay, so. Really, the system that we're considering is something probably most of you know. It's just the Tauless pump. Okay, so the Tauless pump is a one-dimensional system in which we periodically change both the staggered hopping potential and the staggered on-site potential. And we do it in such a way that we enclose a degeneracy point in the middle. Okay, so this is our looping parameter space. This is a degeneracy point where I close the gap. And if I completely fill the vent, Tauless showed that if I completely fill the, say, one of the bands, that I'll get the net quantized current per period in this system. And basically comes from the fact that at least on the single particle level, this type of Tauless problem has been realized very recently in cold atom systems. Now, the quantization of the current comes from the fact that you can view it in different ways. One way to view it is to consider the quasi-energy spectrum of the system. Okay. Now, if you have a quantized current in a one-dimensional system, as we discussed before, it could come from the fact that you have only one band whose the EDK basically, and the integral of the EDK basically is 2 pi. That would give you a quantized current. However, this type of situation is not possible in a one-dimensional system coming from Hamiltonian dynamics. This situation is possible. So you can have a situation of two bands. One of them is a right mover and one of them is a left mover. And what happens in the Tauless pump is indeed that you have these two bands, but they're adiabatically separated. Okay, so there is a very big energy gap between these two states, but you don't see this energy gap in the quasi-energies. So in terms of quasi-energies, these states completely overlap. Okay, so now, I want to consider a situation where I completely, I partially fill this, say, right-moving band. And I turn on interactions, I want to see what happens. So in order to see what happens, you need to basically separate two types of interactions. You have two types of scattering processes. You have a scattering process, which we call intraband, in which particles scatter and remain within the same band. So here, these two particles in the green band scatter and remain within the green band. And you have interband scattering, in which particles basically scatter, say, from the right-moving band into the left-moving band. If you can get a situation that the interband scattering is suppressed with respect to the intraband scattering, then basically you have a very interesting situation in which particles only thermalize within one of these bands. So you're going to get a very quick thermalization, but only within this right-moving band, while the left-moving band remains completely empty. This would basically what we want to claim, what we will show you, is that this situation will lead to this kind of universal quasi-steady state behavior. Since time's getting short, basically I maybe lost some of the details, but basically this is exactly the situation you get for low frequency driving. Because of the energy separation between these two bands. So as I said, the right moving band would come, say, from this lower energy state. So these are the instantaneous energies. While the left moving band would come from this higher energy state. And due to this energy separation, you also have a separation of the eigenstates in terms of their Fourier harmonics. So this is the Fourier transform. This is the periodic piece of the wave function, and this is the quasi-energy part. Okay, and there is a separation in this. If you look at the components in Fourier space, there is a separation in Fourier space coming from the energy gap in the system, which basically leads to a suppression of inter-band scattering. So if you look at two particle states, they have very little overlap, while if you look at intra-band scattering, the states would have a large overlap. Because they're overlapping in harmonic space, and here they're not overlapping in harmonic space. Okay, so here's an example. So here the black state is the right moving band, the red is the left moving band, and you could see, for example, these are intraband scattering. You could see the overlap between two particle states for intraband scattering. While for interband scattering, this is an example for an intraband scattering. You can see that there is basically almost complete this separation between these two states. And basically, this is the mechanism that leads to this intermediate time behavior. In this intermediate time, which is bigger than this intraband scattering rate and smaller than this interband scattering rate, you basically have a state which is infinite temperature within this right-moving band. And this also tells you If indeed this state is an infinite temperature state within this band, it also tells you that the current is also quantized. The current attains a value which is quantized times the density of particles. Okay? At long times, of course, the current decays. So let me just show you for a numerical example. So we initialize the system. Initially, it has some arbitrary current that just comes from the initial conditions. But you see that at very short times, the system basically equilibrates. It reaches this infinite temperature state, which, up to finite size effects, has this quantized value. The density here is half, so it's basically this is exactly what you expect from this kind of infinite temperature state. And then it decays at longer times. Now, one point that I'm not going to details about is that. What's important here is that this decay time can actually be exponentially separated from this initial equilibration time. Okay, it can be exponentially separated in the gap divided by frequency. Okay, so if you think about the gap over the frequencies of your large parameter, you could have an exponential separation between these two times, and here is another numerical example where we indeed took this parameter to be larger, and you see that here this chiral state remains basically within its quantized, retains its quantized value for the current for a very, very long time, much longer than this one, and much, much longer than the initial equilibration time. Okay, so I think that's enough for today. So I've discussed topological phenomena in flow systems, and I've discussed both the situation in the anomalous two-dimensional phase, where we have basically topological edge state alongside completely trivial kind of bulk. We also discussed this universal states can appear, universal quasi-steady states can appear in this adiabatic grinding region. Thank you very much.
What's the difference between that result and previous?
Here? Results?
Yeah.
So the difference is that the frequency here is lower.
Okay.
So what you change is the important parameter is the gap over the frequency. If you change this parameter, you basically increase this equilibration time exponentially.
Okay.
So the equilibration time is, it actually comes out very nice with the numerics. You could see you could actually plot the equilibration time in functional parameters, and you see that it's exponential in this. Parameter delta.
How do you drop that? You can consider your answer. How you feel?
I don't have much. If you're not satisfied yet, then I don't have a better answer. So, I think the scenario where you initially feel a region might be more possible, where just by shaping your potential such that.
I'm going to make a big puddle.
Yeah, you make a puddle with density 1, and then the next kind of plateau is density 0. But if you're not happy with that, then you have to think about something else.
Okay, any other questions?
Okay. So when you say that you were filling, say, only one of the two chiral bands, how are you doing that?
So I'm doing it in a very crude way. You're talking about this system.
Yeah, this system.
So for example, one way would basically be to at an initial time to fill only the lower band. Mm-hmm. Because the right mover band actually comes from this lower band. Okay? So if you fill up only this lower band, you have most of your you have overlap only with the right moving band and not with the left moving band.
Christian, so sign up for this soccer and we'll sing.